You are listening to the Midcurrent Church Podcast. This week's message is from our series titled, Quiet Quitting. For more information and to visit us online, check us out at midcurrentchurch.org and find us on Facebook and Instagram. And now, here is Pastor Sten Carlson with today's message.
I think it's a pretty well-stated fact around here that I might be the least handy person in the entire world. About the most complex project that I'm willing to tackle is the, like, you know, IKEA-like furniture assembly, you know what I'm talking about? And even that, at certain times, really can push me to my limits. For example, this past year, we bought my daughter Lucy a bed on Amazon. This is a picture of the bed you'll see right here. It's a very nice bed. It looks, I'm like, you could do that. That's not a problem. So we ordered the bed. When it arrived, I kid you not, all of the shipping labels and all the information on the box, all in Chinese. And so that was my first clue. I was like, oh boy, this could be an adventure, right? And so I pulled out all 8,000, you know, pieces of the bed, and I located the one little Allen wrench, and I got right to work. A wise person in these kinds of situations probably would have organized all of the parts and laid them out according to the inventory list so you could, you know, properly identify them. Not me. I'm like, boxes open, let's get to work. Step number one, I just kind of shuffling some parts around, finding the first one that I need, rip open a bag of screws. I put two pieces together. Then I disassemble those two pieces because I realized I used the wrong bag of screws. And so I throw those screws back, not necessarily like in the bag, but just kind of, I put the screws back just kind of next to the bag on the floor, and then I open up the proper bag of screws and I toss that, you know, bag, you know, back on the floor, dangerously close to the other open bag of similar but still different screws, okay? You see how this is playing out here, okay? The process went on like this for a few hours until I discovered it all. It actually all, you know, came to a halt when I discovered that I was missing a part of the bed that I needed in order to continue. It took me like, I'm not joking, I think it took me like 15 to 20 minutes to like determine that the part actually had not been included, unfortunately, it hadn't been included in the box as opposed to just, you know, like being buried under cardboard somewhere. But finally, I had determined, okay, yes, the part is actually not here, which means I could not go on any further. And so I was forced to call a mandatory timeout. And I wish, even though it would have made me look like an even bigger idiot, I wish Erica would have snapped a picture of this moment, because here's what it would have shown. I had like successfully managed to build myself like into the middle of the slats of this like half-assembled bed. I also discovered that I had begun assembling it in the wrong direction in this tiny, you know, room of my daughter's. And it also looked like, if you were to have just stepped in, it looked like literally a bomb just went off in the room. There are metal pieces of bed frame just scattered all over the floor in no particular order. Cardboard boxes and long strips of tape are just stacked up in the corner, and the plastic bubble wrap that everything comes in, it was covering everything as if it were confetti that had just fallen from the ceiling in celebration. And buried beneath all of the rubble was all the nuts and the bolts and the screws that I was going to need eventually to put this bed together whenever this part arrived from the other side of the world. I kid you not, I'm sweating profusely. The palm of my hand has like two red blisters from, you know, that tiny little Allen wrench that I'm gripping so tightly. And we had company showing up at any moment. They're coming over for the Super Bowl, right? And I'm standing in the middle, you know, literally I'm like, I'm in between the slats of this bed in this chaos everywhere. I'm standing in the middle of this mess, and I'm just kind of left asking myself one question: how in the world did I get here? Like, I'm literally asking myself, like, how do I manage to get myself into these kinds of messes? Here's the question I want to ask all of you this morning. Have you ever found yourself in the middle of a mess wondering, How did I get here? Like what in the world just happened? I'm hoping that I'm not the only one who has these IKEA-like furniture kind of horror stories, but even if I am, which is highly likely, that's not ultimately, I'm sure you're not surprised, that's not ultimately the kind of mess that I'm like most concerned with. That's not the kind of mess that I ultimately want to talk about today. What I am worried about for you and for me, what I am worried about are some of the other messes in our real everyday life, right? Like what I am worried about is some of the relational messes that we find ourselves in friendships that like just blew up out of nowhere. What I am concerned about is some of like the messes that we get into in marriage that we would have never imagined would be true the day that we stood at the altar saying, you know, I do, right? It's the kind of messes that we end up there. We're going, how did we get here? How did we find ourselves in this mess, right? The messes I'm concerned about are some of the professional messes or the spiritual messes or just the moral or the ethical or whatever kind of messes that we find ourselves in that quite frankly we didn't see coming, because the reality is no one plans to end up in some of these places. And yet every day, so many of us do end up in the middle of some kind of mess that we didn't see coming. And ultimately, it's avoiding these kinds of messes that I want to talk about today as we conclude this series that we have titled Quiet Quitting. Here's where the series came from. What we stumbled upon was this growing trend in corporate America in recent years that had discovered that employees in the working world are, you know, it's been identified that there's a trend growing, that employees are just kind of doing the bare minimum requirements of the job, not giving any extra effort, any extra enthusiasm than is just absolutely necessary. And it's the whole trend of just kind of, you know, doing only the minimum of what's required. It's been referred to as quiet quitting, right? What they discovered is no one's actually, you know, quitting their jobs. They're just kind of going through the motions. They're just kind of phoning it in, hoping to get by. And so we borrowed this phrase and this idea to warn of a similar kind of like spiritual apathy creeping into our own lives. And this kind of apathy is partly to blame. What I want to suggest to you today, this kind of apathy is partly to blame or mostly to blame maybe for some of the biggest messes that we may find ourselves in. Now, I don't exactly know where you find yourself today. I don't know what you have or you know are currently walking through in your life right now, but here's what I do know. Some of the biggest messes, here's what I would suggest to you, I should say. Some of the biggest messes in which we will ever find ourselves can all be traced back to the very same thing. Okay? All across the planet, for all of human history, it's the very same decision that I would suggest has been sabotaging the lives and the marriages and the families and the careers and the reputations and the spiritual lives of all of humanity, right? People, are from all walks of life, yes. Each situation that people find themselves in is unique, yes. The circumstances everyone is in the middle of vary greatly. The consequences of the choices that we make are wide-ranging, yes, but the culprit for whatever kind of mess that it is so often the very same thing. Situations different, people, walks of life different, consequences different, circumstances different, culprit, very same thing that no one saw coming. And so today I want to try to help us avoid what that is that so often leads to all of the messes that we find ourselves in. I want you to know what it is. And the way we're going to discover is by turning to Scripture, to the stories throughout the Old Testament to help us discover what it is. We're going to see what it is, the thing that I think we've got to be aware of and to avoid. We're going to see it most clearly in the life of David, the famous king in the days of the Old Testament. David was a kid full of nothing but faith in God. He was a gifted musician. This is kind of cool. He slayed a giant. He became a great military leader, and he became a great king. And he goes down in the history books as a man after God's own heart, truly one of the spiritual greats. But at one point in his life, he screwed it all up. And I think we can learn a really great lesson from his bad example. So turn your attention to me, with me to 2 Samuel chapter 11, where the upward trajectory, here's what we need to know. 2 Samuel chapter 11, we're going to drop into the story. It's at this moment when the upward trajectory of David's life takes a catastrophic turn for the worse. Here's chapter 11, verse 2. This is where things start getting pretty ugly. It says this: one evening, David got up from his bed and he walked around the roof of the palace. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. From, you know, in the way their cities were kind of set up, you know, roof were at different levels. And from his vantage point, he could see over so much of the city. He saw a woman bathing, and the woman, it says, was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. This man returned and said, "She's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." And then David sent messengers to get her. And she came to him and he slept with her. Verse 5, worst case scenario, it says the woman conceived and she sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." Okay, strike one. Right, David sees another man's wife, sends someone to get her, and this is where they end up. David knows he screwed up. He tries to cover his tracks. He sends for Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, and he tries desperately to get Uriah to go home to be with his wife so that he'll think he is the father of the child that Bathsheba is carrying. It gets even uglier. It's so unfortunate. David, Uriah's like, I can't skip out on my duties here. And David's like, please go home. David even tries to get him drunk. He tries to get Uriah drunk that he thinks might help the romantic evening that he's trying to plan for the two of them. But get this, in an ironic twist based on where the rest of this story is going to go, Uriah wouldn't leave his post, right? He's too honorable to skip out on his responsibilities. And so David's going, all right, this plan isn't going to work. And so he starts getting desperate and to try to cover his tracks. And so he comes up with a plan to have Uriah killed out on the battlefield. Skip down to verse 14. In the morning, it says, David wrote a letter to Joab, who's the commander of his army. He sent a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. This is bizarre. Uriah is like carrying his own death sentence, right? Verse 15, in it, David wrote to Joab, "Put Uriah out in the front where the fighting is the fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." And so while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. And then when the men from the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Okay? So David's ugly plan, you know, to deal with Uriah, his ugly plan is successful. He may have felt like he, like, whew, you know, dodged a bullet. He may have felt in the moment like he avoided the mess, but things are about to go from bad to worse. Here is just the Cliff Notes 10,000 foot kind of version, Cliff Notes version of David's life from this moment on. David's child with Bathsheba, he actually, when Uriah dies, Bathsheba comes to him to be his wife. Here's what happens, Cliff Notes version. David's child with Bathsheba would get sick and die, which the prophet Nathan would tell David was a result of his unfaithfulness. And then as you keep fast forwarding through the rest of David's life, the rest of his family, his sons and his daughters, right, the rest of his family would start to unravel in catastrophic fashion right under his nose. His daughter would be sexually assaulted by her own brother, and because of David's negligence in it all, he kind of sat on his hands, did nothing. One of his sons, Absalom, he's so enraged by this, he took matters into his own hands, and so he goes and kills his brother Amnon, who had assaulted his sister, and Absalom would ultimately, because David is doing nothing, he just kind of turned a blind eye to his family falling apart right under his own nose. Absalom is so filled with hatred and rage for his father, for how he could let all of this stuff happen, that he would ultimately lead a rebellion. He would attempt to lead all of Israel in a rebellion against his own father, try to have his own father overthrown. The whole ordeal makes the family drama on the Dr. Phil show look like child's play. I mean, it's an absolute disaster playing out in David's home. He had made a royal mess. But here's the question that I want to ask you. Here's the question I want you to think about today. Which mistake was David's worst mistake? I mean, which one was the most costly mistake that he could have made? What was it? The options are endless. I want us to think, which was the worst one? Which was the most costly mistake? Was it not protecting his daughter? I mean, here we are talking Father's Day. What an incredible privilege it is for God to call us to. I mean, you know, that's our, in the church where we say, that's our first ministry, man. The people under your own roof, your own family. Was that his most costly mistake, failing to protect his daughter? Or was it avoiding the conflict that ensued? He's so kind of like conflict averse. Or was it lying to his servants when Joab had questions about the battle plans that he was getting? David kind of just skirted the issue and told him some half-truths about, was lying the most costly decision that he made? Or was it actually murdering Uriah? Was it arranging for Uriah to be killed in order to cover up his tracks? Was that the worst? Was it betraying his own men? Was this the most costly mistake? Or was it sleeping with Bathsheba? Is that the one that was just the most costly that set this thing into motion? Or maybe his most costly mistake was, you know, failing to, you know, up on the roof. Maybe his most costly mistake was failing to, you know, bounce the eyes. Every young Christian man, maybe that was his most costly mistake. He had a chance to look the other way when he saw Bathsheba and he didn't do it. Maybe that was the mistake that ruined everything. You can make a case for each one being pretty bad, right? Each one of these proved to be a pretty costly mistake, but I'm not sure that any of them were like the first domino to fall. As destructive as each of these mistakes were, I'm not sure that any of them were solely responsible for the mess that David found himself in. His mess was not, what I would suggest to you, his mess was not a result of any of these really obvious mistakes, but rather something far less obvious. The question is, what was it then? Where did things really go wrong? Well, here's where I think things start to unravel. Rewind all the way back to verse 1. Chapter 11, 2 Samuel chapter 11, begins with a seemingly trivial detail. It begins with a seemingly just kind of insignificant footnote to the story that we might not put a whole lot of stock into, but listen to how chapter 11 begins. It says this: in the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. In the spring, when kings go to war, King David didn't. Now, just a little context to help, you know, fill this out here. In the Middle East, this is what this is. This isn't an insignificant footnote. This is how things would go, right? In the Middle East, springtime, it marked the end of the rainy season, which meant a couple of things. It meant that the roads would now be in good condition for travel. And it also meant, end of the rainy season, it also meant that agriculturally speaking, which is kind of how the world operated then, what it meant is that all of the harvest fields would have been in full swing, right? The harvest would have been plentiful, meaning that there would have been plenty of fodder for war horses, you know, hay and wheat and all the stuff would have been growing. There would have been plenty of fodder for war horses and pack animals, and it means there would have been plenty of harvest to be kind of, you know, raided. You know, there would have been plenty of harvest to be raided in the fields when armies were on the move. This was the time when kings went to war. So this was the time when a king like David should have been off to war with his army. The author is kind of pointing to something with this seemingly insignificant footnote. The author is alluding to the fact that, like, every other able-bodied man in Israel went off to war, but the author is careful to note every able-bodied soldier except for David, except for the king. Now, here's the deal. We don't know why he stayed home, but here's what we do know at this particular moment in his life. He is at the peak. If you go back to 1 and 2 Samuel, tracing David's life, what you see is he is at the peak of his rise to prominence. He's slayed Goliath. He's been successful in battle. People are singing his praises all over the place. He had faithfully served King Saul. You know, that was Israel's first king. He had been a faithful servant of King Saul, never tried to grab power away from Saul, even when Saul was fading and David had been appointed to be the next king. Even when he had the chance to, he never tried to grab the throne away from Saul. He even mourned publicly and he grieved publicly the death of Saul, his eventual enemy who in jealousy was trying to have David killed. When Saul died, David, he publicly and you know, he grieves and he mourns the loss of Saul. It's after all of this, David's just demonstrating incredible faithfulness at every moment of his life. It's after this that David experiences a season of incredible success and of incredible blessing. All of Israel is singing his praises and all of Israel is begging him to be their king, a responsibility which he does accept. And that's where he finds himself, right? So again, I don't know for sure, but it's possible when you consider the trajectory, it's possible that his decision to stay home, it's possible that it was just him doing what so many good leaders are encouraged to do, delegate. I mean, I've heard 1,000 times, right? The sign of a good, you know, leader is how well the team operates when the leader is gone, right? So maybe David thought like, hey, they got this. Maybe he's going, hey, they don't need me. I'll just let them take care of it. I'll just sit this one out. It doesn't say. I don't know exactly what he was thinking. But it does appear to me, based on the way this is all laid out for us, it does appear to me that this decision to stay behind in Jerusalem was the beginning of the end. Forsaking, right? Skipping out on the one responsibility that God had given him as king of Israel. Skipping out on that responsibility, it proved to be the most costly decision that he would ever make. And here's what I think, right? I'm telling you, there we can learn a good lesson from his bad example. Here's what I think we need to understand. Here's what we learn from this as a result. That our most costly mistake, it might be our absence so much more than our disobedience. Okay. Am I saying that moments of disobedience, when we knowingly, make the wrong choice, am I saying that that stuff it doesn't matter and is inconsequential? No, I'm not saying. But when I look at David's story here, when I try to trace it all the way back to what's the first domino that fell, what I start to realize is that our most costly mistake in any moment, it might just be our absence in a given moment so much more than our disobedience. Right, the biggest messes that we make, they're not always a result of the biggest, most obvious, most egregious mistakes that we make, but rather they are a result of the small, seemingly inconsequential moments when we didn't show up for the responsibilities that God had entrusted to us. Sometimes it's those moments that make all the difference in the world. It's not the big, obvious misses. It's the small moments and the small absences along the way that make all the difference. Here's what you have to understand about David's story. We got to understand that his story and of this failure, right? Here's what you have to understand. It didn't prove that he was a fraud. Okay, it didn't reveal the fact that he really wasn't a man after God's own heart. It doesn't mean that he hadn't been a great leader or that he hadn't been a good dude. His story just demonstrates the danger, hear me, of quietly quitting on the responsibility that God had given him in a particular moment. It demonstrates the danger for you and me then of quietly quitting on some of the responsibilities that God has given us in the matter, in the moments that we think, hey, maybe this one doesn't really matter. His story is a warning to you and to me that when we fail to show up for the things that we know we ought to do, it oftentimes leads to so many of the things that we were taught not to do. Midcurrent, what I want us to understand is that sometimes it's the subtle absence in the midst of the everyday, mundane moments of our life. It's not just the moments of blatant disobedience. Sometimes it's just our absence in the midst of the everyday, mundane moments of our life that lead to the messes that we never saw coming and to the messes that we do not want to be in the middle of. And so let me just ask you this. Where is it, if you took some time to think, to evaluate, to do kind of a little audit, little inventory of your own life, your own heart. Where is it that like your absence somewhere that God has called you to, your absence within a responsibility that God has maybe placed on you, where is it that your absence might be doing more harm than you realize? Where is it that your absence may not be as innocent and as insignificant as you might think it is? It's Father's Day, so let me just take a minute and talk to some of the dads in the room. Gentlemen, your most costly mistake with the responsibility that God has given you to raise and to care and protect your kids, right? Your most costly mistake, it may not be the yelling. It may not be that the one moment when you lost your temper. It may not be the one moment when you were just way too hard on the kids. I'm not saying that stuff doesn't matter. I'm not saying that stuff doesn't impact your kids, right? It does. I'm just saying that oftentimes the costly mistake, it's not the loudest one. It's the quietest one. It's the one that people may not really even notice anymore, right? It's not the big, loud moment. It's the quiet one. It's just the absence in all of the moments that mattered most. It's scrolling on your phone after work when your kids are actually on the floor hoping that you'll join them there. Or it's being way more excited about the game on the big screen than the game that's playing out in the backyard without you. Right? It's investing, you know, too much. It's studying, you know, too much the playbook for the upcoming season more than studying and teaching the playbook that we have for this life that God has called us to live and has asked us to help, you know, teach to our kids as well. It's not the big loud moment that leads to some of the biggest messes. It's the quiet moments when we just weren't present. Husbands and wives, your most costly mistake that leads to the mess that you're going, man, how did we get here? It may not be the big fight that you just had. It might be a result of the conversation that you didn't have, that you never have. Right? The mess that you don't want to find yourself in, it will most likely be the result, not of like the one time that you blew up at each other, but all the little times that you just didn't show up when you weren't there, maybe physically, or maybe you were there physically, but you weren't there emotionally or relationally or spiritually. You weren't present in the relationship or in the moment, right? You stopped going first. You stopped caring. You stopped loving. You stopped serving the one that you promised yourself to. Your most costly mistake at work, it may not be the project that you bombed or the deadline that you missed or the deal that you didn't close or the investment that flopped. It might be the investment that you never made into the people that you work with and the mission that y'all had committed yourselves to together. And it might have been the investment that you didn't make with the gifts that God had given you. Your most costly mistake in your neighborhood, right? It might not be the disagreement that blew up over property lines. The biggest mistake might just be never creating a line of communication that allowed you to get to know the name and the story of the people that God had placed right next to you. Most costly mistake in your spiritual life, in your heart, it might not be, you know, the mess that unfolds. It might not be a, you know, the result of like the one bad word that you let fly or the one finger salute that you gave to someone in traffic. Oh, that's when it all went. It might not be the big, you know, moments. It might just be that all the moments that you never showed up. It might be the moments that you just didn't prioritize your spiritual life and the relationship that you were pursuing with Jesus. Gang, absence in all of the little mad moments that we don't think maybe matter all that much. Absence in those moments is the silent killer that is destroying so much of the good that I think God wants to see flourish in the world and in you and me. So we've got to learn how to show up more. We've got to, you know, learn how to embrace the responsibilities that God has entrusted to us. And if we're going to do that, I think I don't want to seem trite here, but I think if we're going to do that, we've got to practice saying yes. We've got to learn the art of just having an attitude that we're going, hey, I'm going to say yes every single day, right? What if we made every single day that we wake up in our spiritual life, even what if we made every day a yes day? Anyone seen the movie Yes Day while we're on the subject here? A couple hands going up. Okay, it's a movie that, you know, as parents tell their kids for one day, every question you ask, the answer is going to be yes to. Ever since my kids saw it, they're like, Mom and Dad, we need one of those Yes Days. what if our spiritual lives, the things that God has entrusted, what if we did the same thing in our spiritual life? What if we made every day a yes day? What if we said yes more to what it is that God has called us to? What if we said yes more to who it is that God has called us to be? Or yes more to the responsibilities that God has given us? Or yes to the people that God has called us to love and serve? Yes to the people that He's put in our sphere of influence every day? What if we just every day I'm just going to say yes to you, God. Yes, even when it doesn't make sense. Yes, even when I don't really quite understand, or yes, even when I don't totally see or know how this is gonna end. What if we just made every day that we had breath in our lungs a day that we said yes? The great news, here's what I want to say. I don't know where you find yourself. The great news about God's call on our lives is that no matter what has happened to this point, it's never too late. That's what's so great. It's no matter what mess you might have ever found yourself in, it's never too late to just start saying yes. And so I want to ask you, where is it that this kind of attitude, where is it that like a yes day for you, where is it that could make all the difference? Here's what I want to tell you as I encourage all this, right? Because this is not intended to be some kind of extra burden that we've got, like, oh my goodness, every day. This is not supposed to be some kind of extra load. What I want to make sure that you know, if we're going to do this, if we're going to try to embrace this attitude, I want you to know perfection is not the goal. It's not possible. Perfection is not the goal. But our presence in the places that God has called us to, that's the goal. And so I'm praying that we might embrace the responsibilities that God has entrusted to us like we never have before. I don't want us quietly quitting on the things that God has called us to. And so to help us try to put an exclamation point on the end of this, I just asked Josh and the band to close us with a song that I'm hoping would turn into the commitment that more of us would be making in all of the places that God has given us influence today. So whatever it is for you, as you sit here, listen, take this song in, let it be an encouragement to you. Let it be the words that you express to God. Whatever it is for you, I'm praying that you would say yes to it. Yes to whatever God has called you to. So once again, let these words be sung over you. Let them be your prayer. Let them be your commitment. But let's all of us find ways to say yes more to what it is that God has in store for us. Hey God, we're praying that you might help us to identify in our lives the places where you're hoping we would say yes just a little bit more often, God. And I want you to remind us that perfection is not the goal. But God, remind us of the power in our presence to show up faithfully into the moments, into the places, God, that you have called us to be the people that you called us to be, to love the people that you called us to love, and to serve the people that you called us to serve, God. Help us to be mindful of the little moments, God, just as much as the big moments that we make sure we try to avoid as much as possible. God, help us to realize how much our presence matters more than we might think. And as we say yes to you, God, I pray that you really would help us to see the harvest that is just around the corner, God, to the life that you've called us to live and the impact that you want us to have. Wherever we go, God, help us to understand the significance of our presence. You modeled it for us when you sent your son to be present in this world to help us all avoid the biggest mess that we ever had on our hands. And so, God, help us to follow your example of understanding the significance and the power in our presence in the moments that you called us to. And we pray this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this week's message from Midcurrent Church. For more information and to visit us online, check out midcurrentchurch.org and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to join us on Sunday mornings, both online and in person, at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Midcurrent is located at 200 First Street in downtown Hudson, Wisconsin.